Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. Meet Aisha Turman, yet another woman with many titles after her name. Educator, writer, storyteller, filmmaker, artist, activist, mentor, mom. And they're all interconnected. There's plenty to talk about when it comes to Ms. Turman, who happens to be an educator at the Brooklyn Children's Museum, which, by the way, is the world's first children's museum. It opened in December of 1899. Tired of not seeing positive images of black women and girls in the media, Turman decided to take matters into her own hands. So 6 years ago, with little film experience, she made the documentary The Black Girl Project. Its goal, in her words, to have black girls speak their truths. What started as a film grew into a movement, actually a nonprofit organization that uses the film, identity, obstacles, goals, family, stereotypes, to help build critical thinking, inspire dialogue, and empower these girls and women. The Black Girl Project happens to be an extension of Super Hussy Media, the company Turman founded, which explores what it is to be black and female. Super Hussy's goal is frank dialogue surrounding the issues of race, class, gender, spirituality, and sexual orientation, and the roles they play in the lives of black women and girls. Lots to talk about, so let's not waste any more time, and welcome Aisha. Hi.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Well, first things first, what is the genesis of the name Super Hussy, and was it a turnoff to a lot of people?
I've always loved comic books, particularly Wonder Woman. I grew up watching the series as a little girl. Mm-hmm. I would spin in front of the TV. I was her for Halloween several years in a row. And so I wanted something that evoked that, something heroic. Hussy, my maternal grandmother did not swear. She was very proper, Southern lady. But when she called you a hussy or called someone else a hussy, you know something was up. And so that's really just in honor of her. She was a really big force and a big presence in my life. And I wanted to show a different side of her in a way, because most people know her as the sweet, genteel woman.
Mm-hmm. So you don't see that there's sort of two opposing terms, super and hussy?
Not at all. Not at all. I think they go together perfectly, actually.
So would you like to be called a hussy?
I'm fine with it.
Okay.
I'm completely fine with it. I think a lot of people have issues with the word because of how they were taught the word meant. And I'm really a big fan of language and of words and word usage. And knowing that the word, you know, comes from the German for housewife and how its meaning obviously changed over the years. You know, I'm a big fan of embracing things and creating meaning for what you want to make, mm-hmm. not necessarily going along with general consensus.
Because hussy could certainly be viewed as a pejorative term.
It could be.
Hussy.
Yes, it could be. And so, I've gotten emails from people about the name, and I'm like, well, you know, that's your issue, not mine.
So, we'll go back to Super Hussy, mm-hmm. but I want to know what led up to the Black Girl Project.
Sure. I was a coordinator of a high school cultural arts and academic internship program. So we had about 50 students, and it was in Brooklyn. And all of the girls were coming to me with their business, which was great. You know, they knew that I was a safe space and a safe person that they can come to tell me anything. And actually, the boys were coming to tell me their business, too. But the girls were telling me everything. And part of it was, I can't believe 20 years after I've graduated from high school, it's the same stuff. Particularly within communities of color. Most of my students, all of them would term themselves African-American. Most of them were of Caribbean descent. So either they had come when they were children or they were born here and their parents came here. So they weren't that far removed. And with my background, with having had grandparents who were from the South and who were born pretty close to the turn of the 20th century, you know, a lot of the ways of being are similar, are very, very similar. And I was just like, really, y'all are dealing with this stuff? Why? You know, let's talk about this. Let's talk about this. And another part of it was, you know, in the media, what we see of black women is, and it's gotten worse, I feel.
Isn't that terrific?
Since
that
then.
It's gotten worse. Yeah.
It's gotten worse. I don't ever see myself or people I know represented And, you know, I understand the idea of movies. I understand the idea of television. You take yourself out of your reality. But if I can't
identify,
even in the small kernel with people, then, yeah, you know. And
well, what were these young women saying to you? What were they lamenting or what was upsetting them?
Not really having to be able to actually have a space to talk to someone, or being discouraged from going outside of their family or outside of their religious communities to have dialogue with someone. I had a student who wanted to go to therapy, and her mother literally said, you know, you don't put our business in the street, you know, and that's, you know, a long-standing thing in a lot of communities, particularly ethnic communities. Mm-hmm. You know, we are insular. We're going to be all right. We're going to take care of ourselves. Selves. You know, the statistics show that, you know, mental health issues in communities of color, you know, they still go untreated. They're, you know, there are high rates of depression because people are too afraid, too ashamed, or don't have access to the services they need, you know? So I was able to find, like, free or low-cost service providers for...
So you were more than just a listening device, as it were.
Right.
You were proactive. Here, I'm going to match you up with thus and such.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. Like, go see these people. These people are free. Mm-hmm. Even, you know, conversations about sex and sexuality, you know, not being able to have those kinds of open conversations with their mothers or aunts and their families. And so not really having those tools, mm-hmm. you know, available to them. And particularly at that time, and even pretty much now, there was really no really grounded, full, comprehensive sexuality education in New York City schools. So they're not getting the information that they need. You know, they're getting it from each other, which is like, no.
Mm-hmm. Or Miley Cyrus.
You know, they're getting it from popular culture. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the way to go. Mm-hmm. So I, you know, was able to bring in people to speak to them.
So this was your side job, in a sense.
Well, that was my full job. Like, my job was, I was coordinator of this program. So I laid out the curriculum,
right.
All of that.
Right.
But then I became this extra. So I considered it as part of the job,
okay.
Not, you know, like I'm doing you a favor. I'm like, you know, I'm here. I'm a resource for you. I want to be a resource for you. I think it's vitally important for young people to have an adult in their life outside of their family who is non-judgmental.
And who they can trust.
Who they can trust and come to with anything. And I became that for a lot of young women. And I'm still in all their lives now.
Well, that's a testament.
Yes.
That says a lot.
Yes, I know all their business. And they're part of my life, too.
Did you feel that you brought some of the girls back from the edge?
Yes. A couple of our young women. I definitely feel with being able to provide them with the resources that they were able to get, they were able to, like, stabilize and normalize their lives. Not everyone worked out that way, but... You know, as they were getting older and I was still present, because I'm non-intrusive, so I would just, hey, you ever thought about this?
Mm-hmm.
Ever thought, you
mm-hmm.
know? And I'm not one to tell people what they should do, because that didn't work with me when I was a teenager. So I know it's not going to work. But I would give information and you know, send an email, send something via Facebook message or anything like that, just to give them information that they need. And so all of these young women that I worked with at that time are all healthy, thriving, you know, and they've all had their hiccups like we all do in life.
But here's the thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's one thing to advise and listen and tend to and be sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's another thing to give birth to a movie, to give birth to a project. I mean, how did you do that? Because you didn't know how to do that.
I had no clue at all.
Okay. So
my last full year as project coordinator, every year we have the teens create a huge project together, 9th through 12th grade, toward the spring. And I had the bright idea, hey, they should make a film. Because this way, I figured I'd be teaching them. And in order to teach them, I have to teach myself. That's how I learn. I learn by doing. So they made this 20-minute short film that was actually based on Spike Lee's film School Days. It was called High School Days.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all kinds of hilarious drama. They wrote it. They did everything.
And how
for
many
this
kids
film.
Were involved in this?
About 43 kids.
Boys were in, and girls.
Boys and girls, 9th through 12th grade.
Okay.
So they made this film together, which was wonderful, and they had a great time. And so I'm like, okay, now I have skills. I have skills. So I had a DSLR camera. And I had a program that a lot of anthropologists use. It's a free program that you can record. You can audio record on. It's Mac based. And so I went and I downloaded that, had that. And I said, OK, Aisha, what do I want to do? I want to make a film where they are telling their stories and they're just being human and it's just their voices. Okay. And I was no longer working with them. I was gone at this point. And they were all like entering college as well, for the most part. And I said, okay, this is what's going to happen. So I started sending emails. Hey, I have this idea for a film. You know, and I, you know, we have this relationship. Every single person I asked said yes. You know, and so it was really easy in the sense that I didn't have to prod them with questions and like, hey, how you doing? How are you? Tell me about your life.
And so you're shooting and they're talking.
And they're just talking and they're just talking. And I have 9 young women and they're diverse. They would all consider themselves Black. However, they're Panamanian, Puerto Rican, Haitian, Jamaican. And I also wanted to show that, too, because we have this myth that there's this monolithic Black thing. Like, you know, there's this Black community and they all fall under this one
umbrella. So there's diversity within.
There's diversity within that group and diversity within experiences and diversity just all throughout the culture.
There's no stereotyping.
No.
Which is really, I would imagine, so irritating.
Quite a bit, quite a bit. But that's how the film came to be.
And you edited it?
Yes, I had. Yes, 2 years. The first time I actually spent money on the film was when I went to go buy a DVD to burn it for the first time. So I would meet them at their homes. I would catch them when they would, the kids who went out of state or went out of New York City for school, I would catch them on their vacations when they would come in. And I literally had 72 hours.
Wow.
Worth of audio and video. And I just decided, okay, here's a story. Here's a framework. You know, being a writer, I set it up like it's a book. There's an introduction. That's the only time you hear my voice is in the beginning of the film. There's an introduction. And then we go right into their stories. And they're, all of their stories overlap. And it's set up via, you know, we talk about goals, literally goals, obstacles.
Give me one heart-wrenching story.
Heart-wrenching story. A young woman who, brilliant, brilliant young woman. She was in the Prep for Prep program where they take students from disadvantaged communities and they prepare them to go into these elite schools. Brilliant, brilliant, brilliant young woman. And she graduated from high school, went to a large university. And she was out by the end of her first semester. And she hadn't been able to deal with a whole lot of things. There was depression, and it was heavy depression. She was one of those young women, and similar to myself, she developed early. So I think I had a kinship with her from that, you know, being a 10-year-old girl, but in a 16-year-old's body. Uh-huh. So she had that issue. She had the fact that she stood out because she was so smart. And so she was in all of these programs.
Tremendous pressures.
Because of the film, I had not known this. I knew her for like 3 years, and I had not known that she had been a cutter. Something that we do not talk about in the Black community at all. We do not talk about self-harm. And she was a cutter, that she was sexually assaulted, that she had made more than one suicide attempt. You know, all of this came out in our conversation.
This filmed conversation.
Well, I did not film her. I photographed her and I recorded her voice.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was not filmed speaking about
it. But she's part of the
film. Oh, she's part of the film, yes, yes. And parts of these stories come out.
Right. And so she was so overwhelming for this poor young woman.
Yeah, she stopped going to class. She said that she literally withdrew. You know, she's at this large university. And, you know, similar to myself, she went from a school where I think they had like 150 graduates to a school with 50,000 people.
Wow.
Yeah, and I did the same in my life, too. So.
But the irony is there was probably a lot of support systems
that she didn't know about
or was uncomfortable using.
Yeah.
Is she okay today?
She's okay today. She's working.
She graduate?
No. She has not gone back to school yet.
Okay.
You know, but she's really been working on herself. And she's a lot more positive and a lot more healthy. And that's really all I can ask for, is for her to be healthy and in a healthy space for herself.
Now, contrast that with mm-hmm. a young woman you talked to with a very uplifting story.
Let's see. One student who at one point was homeless during high school, but she graduated from high school. She went on to college. She's now working in the world. So it's, you know, we've had that. We've had another young woman who's, you know, her family came from Haiti and she went on to school. Her sisters graduated from college. She looked at her sister as a motivation. You know, those kinds of stories where family is really the big support system, where she knew that I really am going to make it. I'm going to do this. I have all these people. And it doesn't matter what I have materially. It matters what's inside. We have those stories. And we have stories of struggle, I'm unsure of myself. I've been teased. You know, I looked like this when I was a kid. Then I developed. Now I look like this. People make assumptions about me. I'm afraid to take risks. Like, we have all of these stories. You know, my family, I love my grandmother. My grandmother did this for me. And that was really the purpose for me, is to show all of these.
Just talk. You know, one of your points is so well taken that, you know, everything old is new again, that you're saying what you struggled with. And today, everywhere, women are still fighting that, you know, slogging up that hill, whether it's in business, in life, whatever. It just... stop already.
I think a lot of it has to do with lack of communication and openness and vulnerability. People talk about the success. People like, oh, she's made it here, she's made it there. They don't talk about life, because there's nothing that has happened to you that has not happened to someone else. Like, you are not in a vacuum. You are not alone. But we live in a culture, and it's increasingly a culture, even though the world is getting smaller because of technology, it's also getting to a place where people are not with people as much. And so you have all this time to be in your head mm-hmm. and not out in the world experiencing things. And, you know, change occurs through action. And if you're not out there doing and experiencing, you just spend more and more time up in your head. So you begin to wallow in whatever it is that is going on. So, you know, if you're sad, you become sadder, unless you have appropriate tools to help take you out of those spaces. So I think there's just a lack. I'm a big fan of intergenerational conversation. You know, mothers, grandmothers, aunts, you know, I believe that anyone can mentor anyone else. Mm-hmm. You know, my daughter has been a mentor to me and she's only 9 years old. But we are not having these conversations and they're not public conversations. And there's also that whole need of, you know, that appearance. People are very busy trying to make sure they look good, trying to hide whatever cracks they may have, trying to make everything look shiny. And for me, the cracks are what makes you beautiful.
Well, it's not wanting to show your vulnerability also.
Yeah. You know, but that's, for me, it's how I've grown through my vulnerability, putting myself out there, being transparent. Like, I was one of those people like, oh, no one should know about that. No one should know that I, like, dropped out of college, like, 2 times, 3 times. Mm-hmm. No one should know these things because I'm perfect. I had all these expectations. No one should know about these things.
But people needed to know about your movie. So
yes.
So you edit this down.
Yes.
And then what did you decide to do with it?
Oh, I edited the film. And in the editing process, we had already had a Twitter account for both Super Hussy and the Black Girl Project, which became the Black Girl Project. So I would just talk about it and put things out there and have conversation. And then other people would tweet about it. And I decided that the premiere of the film.
Which was where and when?
Long Island University campus, the Spike Lee screening room. It was all
Spike Lee as in Spike Lee.
Yes. He gave them this screening room for their school. Mm-hmm. And it was in August 2010. And it was a fundraiser to launch us, literally, to do the Black Girl Project work. And I had no idea who was going to come. It's like, it's going to be me and my mother and my daughter sitting here watching this. And the theater was packed. People I hadn't seen since I was 16, 17, 20 were in the audience. Mm-hmm. You know, and people I had no idea who they were were in the audience. So it was the screening, and then we had cocktails and, you know, like, hey, what's this
Feed thing? Them and they will come.
Feed them and they will come. And then we had a panel afterwards, which, you know, proved to be very, very eventful. So, yeah.
And that then was the precursor to your organization.
Yes.
Which is still very much alive and well.
Yes.
And you do what?
Our mission has changed a little bit. Initially, we wanted to tackle that middle school to high school range. But in New York City, there's a lot of stuff for girls in that middle school range. There's so much stuff. And we had initially thought, oh, yeah, we're going to go into schools, do these kind of things. And that model just did not work because we're in a changing world. And as someone who has led programming where kids have to come at certain days, I'm seeing how the world has changed. And I'm a believer that you don't have to do something, 4 days a week, 2 days a week from 2 to 6 to get what you need. So our mission really is to empower young women and girls, both locally, nationally and globally, to use their voices. And to engage as citizens, as global citizens. And we're really focusing now on the 17 to 25-year-old range because I've done screenings at campuses, lots of screenings on campuses, and having either me speaking afterwards or a panel. Some of the young women in the film have been able to go with me to be on panels, and which is always awesome. You know, that is a group that we just throw out there like, you're grown now. Mm-hmm. You know, whether they're in school, whether they're working, you are an adult. I didn't become an adult really till I was like 30. Like, I just was not grown in any sense of the word. Uh-huh. And we treat, particularly women and girls, we treat them like, okay, you're 18, go on out there. And, you know, young women were like, we're struggling. We don't know what's going on. We're just in this liminal space here. And we need help. So now that we've shifted our focus to that age group, and I love that age group.
Who's the we? Because you're clearly not doing this by yourself.
Well, I have an advisory board. Uh-huh. Well, how we became a nonprofit is a long time ago when I ran away to New York as a 19-year-old, I volunteered with an organization who had a fiscal sponsor, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, and they're based in Harlem. And I kind of maintained contact with them, sort of. I sent them an email because I knew they continued to do fiscal sponsorship. I sent them an email, sent them a proposal of what I thought that I wanted Black Girl Project to do, had a meeting, and within a week, we became a project of IFCO. So they handle all of our administrative stuff. We get to do the work. So one of the conditions with that is that I have an advisory board.
I don't want to let go the line that you threw out, just tossed out there at 19 when you ran away from home to New York. Why don't you explain that?
I was completely overwhelmed. Well, I had always wanted to live in New York.
Where did you live?
I was born in Albany, New York, grew up in Rochester, New York.
No wonder you wanted to come to New York.
Can I tell you? Only child, girl, really strong mom. I was one of those, you know, I graduated from high school at 16. I had been in advanced everything from, I think, our age of 10. So overachiever. Went to a very small school, you know, 139 graduates on graduation day.
High school.
Go off to a college with 35,000 undergraduates. I didn't want to go to that school. The school I wanted to go to was a very small private school in New Orleans. I made a case to my mom. Mom, they have curfew. It's run by nuns. None of the dorms are co-ed. They're going to give me a lot of money. She's like, no, I can't get to you. And I said, okay, I get it. I went to school as a biology major, physics minor.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, that's right.
I literally started college the week after high school ended for a special summer program.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you were running as fast as you can.
I was running faster than I had ever even thought possible. Mm-hmm. I had no self-awareness. I was literally very sheltered. When I think about I had a lot of freedom, but I was really sheltered within all that freedom. Because my mother knew everyone in the city of Rochester. So, you know, very sheltered. So I get to this big school. I have a few friends that I was able to make during our summer program. But I just got so emotionally, physically just torn to pieces. It was just...
Just like the woman who you interviewed
yes,
in your film.
I was not... I had, again, like I said, no self-awareness. I was making poor choices. Just, you know, things I knew were stupid. You know, just stupid stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, I'm not going to class.
Oh, that's almost liberating.
Yeah, it is. I stayed at school for about a year and a half. Came home to Rochester, decided I was going to work, had a secret plan with my 88-year-old grandfather who was in Albany. I would go to visit mm-hmm. my grandfather, and the bus changes in Albany. You have to get off the bus to get on the bus in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
So we weren't lying when he said he saw me when he would tell my mother. You're like, yeah, she's here.
Wow.
And he would slip me some money,
wow.
and I would come to New York. I did that like 3-4 times. I had a few friends from high school who were in college here in New York. And I had a cousin who had graduated from school here in New York. I said, I'm going to New York. Did everything I needed. Forged my mother's name on my financial aid application.
Holy cow.
Did everything, you know. All of these things came to New York City.
And the rest is history.
And the rest. And my mother was so angry. Like, my father drove up from Albany. She was like, what are you doing here? I'm taking Aisha to school. What you mean you're taking her to school? My father, you know, had the car. We all packed up the car. My mother jumped in at the last minute. At the last minute. Angry, angry. Of course, within the next year, it was all, you know, my daughter went to New York all by herself as a teenager. She didn't need my help. She just, you know, she's so independent. And that's how
it all started.
It all started.
That's a great
and I
story.
Love New York. And I, you know, it's been my home. I've lived in Harlem. But I've primarily been in Brooklyn most of the time that I've lived in New York, and it's my home.
So what are you doing, for example, to smash the stereotypes that, in your words, describe minority women, mm-hmm. hypersexual, booty shakers, mm-hmm. deviants,
mm-hmm.
unfit, uncaring mothers, mm-hmm. superstars, to go, you know, to the other end of that?
Mm-hmm.
These are heavy-duty
yes.
stereotypes.
Well, as an organization, we have our big event every year is the last weekend of October, and it's called the Sisterhood Summit. And I had been to a lot of youth summits as the adult chaperone, and I began researching them, and I'm not necessarily had been a fan because a lot of them seem like marketing events,
mm-hmm.
but I actually planned this summit to be something different. So we have a call for proposals as if it were an academic conference, or I had attended the Allied Media Conference in Detroit as a presenter, and I screened there, and I loved their model. And so I wanted to use their model for young women. So we get proposals from all throughout the East Coast, Texas, California, and each year we have a theme. This year's theme is Digital Daughters, Black Women and Girls Bridging the Divide. So it's all about life in digital space. So it's relationships, sexualities, your identity, creating businesses in that space. It's all about anything you can think of that can exist digitally. That's what it's about. They choose what workshops that they want to go into, and it's all day long, and it's an 8-hour day of them going in and out of workshops and getting tools that they need for themselves. That's our big program, and what we're working on now is replicating that in other cities. So there'll be Sisterhood Summit Brooklyn, Sisterhood Summit D.C., Philadelphia. That's our goal.
Do you see this as an uphill slog of trying to change images or perceptions of hypersexual booty shakers, deviants, you know?
No. I refuse to see it that way, because
okay.
if I did, I'd pass out. I refuse to think of it as something that's really so difficult that it's almost insurmountable. And I know other people may think that way. I believe if you just do the work, and that if you are authentic in the work that you do, who will come, and they'll get what they need, and they'll eventually pass that information on.
That's a great way to look at it. So let me ask you this.
Mm-hmm.
You're a full-time educator
mm-hmm.
at the Brooklyn Children's Museum.
And I'm a PhD student.
Okay, and you're a PhD student. And you run the Black Girl Project.
Mm-hmm.
And you run Super Hussy Media.
Mm-hmm.
So how is that possible?
Well, we all have the same 24 hours
in a day. That's my exact point. I mean, that's 14 balls you're juggling in the air.
But they're all interconnected. So that's one thing.
Your mother.
And I'm a mom, uh-huh. and my daughter's a big inspiration for me. I'm a mom of a daughter with special needs, so she's a huge inspiration for me. I just do. I'm not working on everything every single day, so that's number one. I don't really care how messy my apartment gets. That's number two. Mm-hmm. Like, I had to work on that. Everything in its place. I'm like, you know what? It's okay if there are a few dishes in the sink. It's mm-hmm. okay if the bed is not made. As long as the garbage is taken out and there's no funny smells, I'm good. So that's one thing. There have been those kinds of trade-offs. Like, I have had to pull back on my own ideas on what being able to do a lot of things look like. Like I said, I'm not working on everything every single day. So that's one of the things. But I just do. I just do. And for me, it's very difficult for me not to have a lot of things to do. That's when it gets crazy. If I don't have several things happening, I'm
more than one burner going.
Yes, I need to have at least three of the four going at once. Yeah.
And you'd never feel overwhelmed.
Oh, I get overwhelmed.
Oh, good.
But I deal with it. Uh-huh. That's what meditation and yoga are for. I'm all about taking care of yourself. So if I need to stop, I stop. I don't have any problems stopping, powering down. No problems with that whatsoever. I'm like, I come first out of all of this. So if I'm overwhelmed or if I'm feeling myself getting overwhelmed, you know, that's, you go for a walk.
So you have a really good sense of self.
Yeah, and self-care is really important. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I do with and working with young people too, talking to them about your own self-care. Not out there. Mm-hmm. You, your container is important.
Well, that sometimes is not innate. It's amazing how that has to be taught.
It has to be taught.
And especially to women.
And yes. And the funny thing is, I have a mother who's been like, girl, you need to take care of yourself. I'm like, yeah, mom, burnout. You know? And it took a while for it to register. Like, it was up here, but in my brain, I hadn't embodied that at all.
Well, I did ask if you feel overwhelmed. I mean, you're a single mom, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's just...
Well, I don't like that term.
Because why?
Because my daughter's dad, he's present in her life.
That's really interesting because that's a term that's bandied about.
I can't stand the term. I mean, I'm not some woman by herself with a kid. I'm not at all. I have his mother. And his mother's here in New York. Even though my parents are not in New York City, the beginning of the summer, my daughter was with my mom. The end of the summer, my daughter was with my dad. I have friends and family. There was a day I was really sick, and I was able to call a friend to go pick her up from where she needed to get, you know, and to bring her to me. You have to create community around yourself. My community has come naturally. I mean, I have former students who I live and work in the same community. And a lot of my students, I can walk to their houses. Mm-hmm. So, and even like...
You're a fixture in your neighborhood.
Yes. From elderly to people. And people know my daughter because she's a bright ray of sunshine.
Uh-huh.
So people, I've been in airport lines and people say, hey, I've had a TSA agent say, I know you. I know your little girl with the afro. I'm like, yes, yes. You know, and I embrace community. I embrace that 10 blocks radius that surrounds me.
I hear everything that you're saying. Mm-hmm. I also think that it can be a little anomalous because that term of people, you know, whether it's a positive or not, oh, she's a single mom, or oh, she's a single mom. It's great to hear you vocalize that.
Mm-hmm. I don't feel that way because I'm not saying that the word is negative or positive. It's just what it is.
It doesn't apply to you.
Right. It doesn't because you know, her dad is taking her to dance class at 9 o'clock on Saturday morning, you know, and he and I have a great relationship. So it's not like, you know, there's some guy over there paying child support or something like that.
Or not.
You know, our goal, we have a child to raise and we are going to be the best relationship that we and I can be in so we can raise a happy, healthy, productive child.
So that's clearly a message in the work that you do.
Yes, yes. You know, it's about doing the best you can for yourself and your life.
Well, I got to tell you, you're doing the best, more than the best that you can. You're really inspirational, Anisha.
Thank you.
And it was such a pleasure to meet you.
It was wonderful to be here.
And I just want to wish you continued success with the Black Girl Project and Super Hussy Media.
Thank you.
And it was really my honor to meet you.
Wonderful. Thank you. Same here.
Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to The 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.